Mr. Fowles, you're with us here today.
Yes.
Good morning to you. You may approach. Mr. Walden, you are also here. Either council have any questions before we begin?
No.
And you may proceed, Mr. Fowles.
Your Honors, I'm John Fowles, here for the appellant plaintiff, Jeremy Barnett. This was a personal injury action that was dismissed by the district court. The genesis of the dismissal was a motion to enforce a mandate. Obviously, this case has a long procedural history. I'll try not to get too deep into the weeds on that. But the case was initially tried, or there was a battle over an offer to confess a judgment. Case with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals decided that that case should be remanded and that the offer to confess judgment was void. But
did the court take any issue or do anything with the monies that were already paid? Was that before the Court of Appeals at all?
Well, it was before the Court of Appeals argument, but it was only a few months before the Court of Appeals argument. The thing to understand here is that after the judgment.
Can I just clarify the word before? Are we talking about in a temporal sense or in the sense of was that something the court was going to decide?
Well, the order, the court initially, the district court initially ordered that there's a judgment, $75,000 against all defendants. Plaintiff appealed because we felt the judgment should only be against one defendant, Happy Cat. We filed an appeal. Now, understand that shortly before the appeal, we received a message from defense counsel, then defense counsel, it's different counsel now, that they were going to pay the judgment. We told them, no, don't pay the judgment because we are appealing. We then proceeded with our appeal. Our issue was that the $75,000 judgment should only be against one defendant, not all three. We filed our briefs. We were just a few months before the oral arguments. There was an issue with the defendant, had not filed his appeal brief, and he was arguing with the Court of Appeals about that, whether he could still do it because he was out of time. And all of a sudden, this check shows up for $75,000 that we did not ask for. We did. Ultimately, we did. Now, this was in consultation with then defense counsel. Our understanding of the reason we were cashing the check was because one defendant was going to be dismissed, and that was Happy Cat. We had a settlement with Happy Cat. They decided they wanted, their then attorney decided he wanted to send us that money. I think I quote his, give his quote in my brief. We accepted the money under that condition that it was a settlement with one defendant and one defendant only. The appeal went on. Now,
so is it, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I'm really deferring this time.
Is it fair to say that the Court of Appeals simply just surprised both parties here with the path they chose to resolve this?
To some degree, yes, but I think that's kind of beside the point. We still reached our settlement. I mean, that was the understanding.
That was going to be my question. Is this a case where we have an offer to confess judgment that is then superseded in part by a settlement that occurred, a second settlement, if you will, while the matter was pending on appeal?
That is my position. That is our position. And I guess that's where I get to one of the issues I have. I have a lot of issues with what the district court did, but one issue with the district court is the district court never even considered that issue.
Well, did they even know about it?
I think they should have known about it based upon the evidence I presented. And certainly we argued that. But based upon the evidence that presented in to the Court of Appeals, I put out the emails. They were offered in evidence. They were part of the record.
What I'm calling the second settlement.
The Court of Appeals didn't know about it, no.
Couldn't have possibly known about it.
They didn't know about it, no.
All right. That's what I was getting at.
Yes.
I beg your pardon. Was the eventuality of what to do with the $75,000 covered by the Court of Appeals opinion? Was there the mandate that came down, and I'll call it in the first round, did the mandate incorporate the opinion? Did the mandate incorporate treatment of the 75?
No, it didn't. It didn't, because the Court of Appeals didn't know that $75,000 was ever paid or accepted. The Court of Appeals didn't know anything about that. This all happened after briefs were filed, at least the plaintiff's briefs were all filed. And so I guess, again, I go back to, I think there was a separate.
So the mandate merely set aside the first confession of judgment and settlement, and it's your position that after that was vacated by the Court of Appeals, you all reached a second settlement.
With one defendant, one defendant.
That was Happy Kim?
Yes. Now, I guess it was before the.
Technically, before they.
Before, yes.
But.
Yes, yes.
Not before.
Yes. And I think that goes to, like I said before, I think one of the primary issues, there was a settlement. The district court did nothing to consider that settlement. Now, I go back to the Pedraza case, which I cited in my brief, that I think that's it. The defendant could disagree with our perception, but it's still a question of fact that he's being tried to the trier of fact, which I think is not the district court judge. I also take issue with the fact the district court judge did nothing. His order did nothing to even address that issue.
Your opponent's position is that this wasn't a second settlement or a settlement at all. I think their position is they were paying the judgment because there was a judgment against them, and that the judgment's been vacated, so the money they paid under the judgment should come back to them.
Well,
if just assume, yeah. Assume for a second, that's their position. What is the correct way for them to get that issue before the district court?
Well,
I assume you're saying the correct way is not by a motion to enforce the mandate, because you say the mandate doesn't address that.
Well,
how should they get that?
Well, there are a couple of issues, I guess. I don't know that I want to necessarily educate them on that, but. But I guess, you know, motion for summary judgment might be a feasible way to do it. I almost, given the way that they approached it with parties, with asking for money from people that were entities that weren't even parties to the lawsuit, I almost thought that a second action would be how they would do it. But I think, you know, you get into, I think one party maybe has a legal claim, the other party maybe has an equitable claim, because you were talking about the insurance company and Happy Cab. And I mean, that was another issue I had with this, is how they approached the parties. I don't think the court had jurisdiction over the insurance company getting their money back. I don't think they had jurisdiction over telling me that I had to pay the money back. And so I think there was jurisdictional issues, and I did address those in my brief. But I also get back to your honor to the point that, you know, the whole premise to their motion was that there was compulsion. I mean, compulsion is kind of a legal term that I think is addressed in the case law in Nebraska. They use the word coercion. I think I cited the Ray v. Sullivan case. In that case, the court said that compulsion or coercion requires actual attempt to execute the judgment. We did nothing to execute this judgment. We told them not to pay the money. We don't want the money because we're appealing.
So it's your position that it was a voluntary payment when it came to you 7 months after?
Absolutely unexpected and voluntary. We did nothing to collect it. We told them we weren't going to collect it. Now, they say, well, we had this judgment. We had to pay it. Well, if we're not going to accept the judgment, they can't get rid of the judgment unless, you know, the money is accepted. Now, I think if there would not have been a settlement, if we would have just taken the money, their remedy at that point in time would have been to seek a dismissal, because you can't, in theory, appeal, accept the money and appeal. That's why we didn't want the money in the first place. We knew we couldn't do that. So their remedy, if what they think, what they say happened, is they should have moved to dismiss at the time we accepted the money. They didn't do that, which I think is evidence that it was a settlement. So I think I'll reserve balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Walden, good morning to you.
Good morning. Your Honors, may it please the court. Raymond Walden for Woodkey and Gibbons, for the defendants. There was no settlement. I mean, what's the evidence of a second settlement, I mean, or a first settlement or whatever? There just wasn't anything of the sort. And the only evidence is some emails that includes a draft of an unsigned receipt.
To which then defense counsel responded by email, looks good.
Looks good. Okay. And that's it. Is there release? There's no release.
It's not nothing.
Well, it's still pretty much of nothing. I mean, there's no, you know, if. Remember where we're coming from with this is the Court of Appeals says there was no meeting of the minds on, you know, on this offer of judgment and acceptance of it. There is far less of a evidence of meeting of the minds on a settlement that takes a, you know, I mean, what's on appeal is a judgment that is against all of the defendants for $75,000. So their point is that they settled then that it's just happy cab, which is what they wanted in the first place. They're kind of leaping on this, you know, some language in the author of judgment that, oh, we accept only as to happy cab and paratransit defendants.
Isn't that how the defendant who was making the offer to confess judgment defined itself? I mean, you're making it seem absurd, but that was their definition.
Yeah, I know that one. But then they follow up with,
what was the purpose of the 75,000 payment after an appeal's been filed? What's that for?
There was a judgment against them. It had not been superseded.
They appealed by the person that was receiving the judgment.
Right. But it's a judgment. Nonetheless, it's a judgment against all of the defendants. So they've paid the judgment. And I mean, in the practical effect, too, part of it is there's a lien against real property and tenements in the county where the judgment exists. I mean, we've got a cap.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman. And maybe we are confusing, or maybe simply I am confused, but there's an order on appeal as to whether or not the district court did or did not do something correctly. And I think encompassed in that discussion is whether or not the district court adhered to the mandate from the Court of Appeals. Now, separately, on a separate track, the parties out there in the wide world were doing things which may not have been circumscribed by the mandate. Do you agree with that?
I do. And the mandate was, it takes that judgment that, you know, out of the picture, vacates it, and says, we're back to the point, you know, we're restoring the parties to the point just before the offer of judgment was made. Okay, so where was that? They were just about to go to trial. Okay, well, how do we get back to that point? That was the point of, you know, we come in replacing the original defense counsel, after the appeal, say, okay, well, let's enforce what the Court of Appeals said to do. How do you do that? Well, we've got to restore the money that was paid on a judgment that no longer exists. And so now we're—
Could you have filed a counterclaim for unjust enrichment or something?
I guess there are various theories that could have been explored, and this is the one that we thought was the obvious one because of, you know, of what the Court of Appeals had said. And we made a payment based upon a judgment that no longer existed, and I think under the law, we're entitled to get that back. And who happens to have it in what bank account where after it was paid to the plaintiff's attorney really isn't relevant. We're not like trying to personally get into, you know, the pockets of Mr. Fowles. You know, if he kept the money in his trust account, whatever. I mean, he's still the representative for the plaintiff. Paratransit paid on behalf of, you know, because it was a liability insurer for a party in the case. That's why the check came from there.
It wasn't a party before the court.
Happy Cab's a party before the court. Paratransit happens to be there.
Happy Cab's insurer was not a party in this case.
Well, that's true. By saying repay that check that came from Paratransit, you know, repay Paratransit is really saying the functional equivalent of saying pay Happy Cab, pay the defendants who made that payment on that judgment that now no longer exists. And the court has discretion to make orders about its, you know, the proceedings in the case. It did so based on the evidence. It had all this evidence about the supposed settlement that really didn't exist. And it made an order. And on appeal, that should be sustained unless there was an abuse of discretion. I think the court was absolutely, you know, right about it. And remember that the order right now that is on appeal is the is the dismissal based on sanction under statute that allows dismissal without prejudice for disobedience of a court order on, you know, proceedings before the court.
But that's exactly what they did. The appellants are challenging whether the court should have ever entered the order to repay in the first place. You're not suggesting they can't challenge that, are you?
Well, no, that's part of it. But the idea that there are non-parties involved, well, really the order, particularly before the court, has to do with that, the dismissal sanction. Based on that non-payment, and I think that was a completely reasonable thing to do. Payment on a judgment that has vanished because of operation of, the Court of Appeals order, and saying that we're restoring it to where we were before. How do we get back there? By letting them have $75,000 that even if we end up winning the case, entirely, they still have the 75,000 is what their position is. Hey, that's great, but that's not how we get back to restoring the way that things were. I think I've covered the compulsion of 25-1504 is that statute that puts a judgment lien on real property, and that's like immediately upon the judgment. So, we're a cab company. I mean, two of the defendants with real property and tenements in the county that's affected of paying on the judgment, right? Could there have been other things possibly to do? Other theories to spin?
Would you agree there's a factual dispute about the nature of the $75,000 payment? Your position being you were paying under compulsion because you were paying a judgment. Plaintiff's position being it was a settlement. You agree there's a factual dispute there?
Not at all. It's clear what the payment was for. At the time it was made, there was nothing going on except there had been a judgment and we're paying on the judgment on behalf of all of the defendants. Then they tried to twist this back.
Indulge me for a second.
Okay.
Assume there is a factual dispute there. Did the district court resolve such a dispute?
I think more to the point, the district court saw there really wasn't evidence to support a settlement.
So is this in the nature of a summary judgment?
It's kind of more in the nature of, as a matter of law, the court has the ability to take a look at settlements that are being presented to it to decide if they're real or not. And
pursuant to a motion to enforce a mandate.
Yes.
I mean, you're saying that the court made a determination based on evidence as a matter of law that there wasn't a second settlement. And I don't see that anywhere in the record.
Whether the court specifically addressed that, I think it's, certainly implied in the fact that these things were presented. I mean, this is part of the record because it went through the district court. The Mr. Files affidavit and his attachments to it. I mean, all of that was before the court. It was argued that a settlement was part of the objection. You can see that in the transcript. So that, necessarily was disposed of to reach the point of saying, well, that money needs to be paid back, because there was definitely the argument being made that, oh no, there was a settlement. That's why the money shouldn't be paid back. Well, okay, no settlement, pay the money. He didn't pay the money. And that was within the discretion of the district court, and asked that be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 1 minute and 54 seconds.
1 minute and 54 seconds. Mr. Fowles.
Let me stress a couple of issues in rebuttal, Your Honors. First of all, their tenements were not at risk. And that's something they keep saying, but that's not accurate, because we had appealed. If we would have done anything to collect the judgment, they could have immediately filed a motion to dismiss. If we had collected the judgment, because that's the law. You can't collect the judgment and appeal.
What if they sold the real estate?
Pardon?
What if they had sold the real estate, which was subject to the judgment? Would that have had to have been satisfied to give clear title?
Possibly we would have let them do it, but they also maybe possibly could have filed the supersedious bond. That might have satisfied that issue too. But again, Your Honor, if we wouldn't have accepted the money, there's nothing you can do about it. It's kind of a non-issue that they keep saying that they had to pay it. Well, if we're not going to take it, it's just going to sit there. The judgment's going to stay. So there's nothing they can do to extinguish the judgment unless we allow it some way or another. So, and back to the issue, I think there's clearly a question of fact regarding the settlement. And again, I would reference the court to that Pedraza case, New West, Pedraza versus New Century. That's an issue for trier fact. The court in this case really did nothing to even address the issue of settlement. It didn't give us any indication in its order that it even addressed it or how it, any findings of fact or conclusions of law or anything to really work with. With that, Your Honors, I will conclude unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in Barnett versus Happy Cab Company.